I'll welcome Dave Muth up. Dave Muth is with ESE Systems, formerly Agsolver, was just recently acquired, but had the pleasure of working with Dave for a number of years now through the partnership, and I'll let you go further into your background, but really looking forward to the talk.
Perfect. Excuse me. Perfect. So we're going to take a little bit of a different angle on how we talk about this. I'm a farmer in North Central Iowa, actually an engineer by training, have gotten into the environmental modeling and the precision ag realm through sort of a twisted and interesting path. So we're gonna bring the economic story together here. So everybody's seen maps like this, okay? There's no surprises here. We understand there's variability. I pulled the legend off of these maps, so this could be a number of different things, right? It could be yield. Maybe we've done some EC mapping and some soil properties. The reality in this case is that it's profit. Fundamentally, right now, we do not manage our fields like businesses. What I mean when I say that is that we invest our working capital to maximize revenue on every acre, but not every acre has significant revenue-producing potential. What we see is about 5 to 20% of almost every field we work in is consistently not profitable, and there's a number of acres on top of that that tend to be pretty mobile in terms of how that business performance works through. Once we understand this, there's a few really important things that jump out that tie us back to the 4R conversation. Right now, there's a notion that environmental and economic performance are competitive. Okay, when we're making field scale decisions, that can be true. But once we understand the scale that business performance is varying within our fields, they're pretty synergistic, and it's actually really simple, right? Places where I'm ineffective at turning my inputs into a commodity, I don't make money, and I tend to have higher loss factors. So we can gain a lot of traction through this conversation. A couple of slides here on what's the real size, scope, and scale here. So right now, we've got amazing data resources. I can come out and identify every field boundary. I can identify the cropping history on that field. I can do a pretty good job identifying subfield yield variability. I know standard expense profiles for different cropping systems. I know standard land costs. I put this all together. I can do a reasonable sub-acre cash flow on every acre in the country without talking to the farmer. Right? It's not necessarily going to be perfect, right? I don't know who's maybe overspending for land or who's managing variable rate and other sorts of precision technologies, but it's a decent gauge. We've done this across the upper Midwest and published some things here with some folks from Iowa State. What we see is in Iowa alone, between 2 and 3 million acres get put in the ground every year where we know fundamentally before we get started that they're likely going to lose money. Okay? That equates to over $1 billion a year in misallocated working capital, a term we use for putting money into an acre that's effectively not going to generate us a return, every single year just in Iowa alone. It's a really intense and immense opportunity for us. I wanted to stretch the geography a little bit here. We've worked on a program within RCS where we're kind of building out this concept of a precision conservation business plan. How do we use the make more money conversation to drive conservation? And I'll talk about conservation. That's sort of a word that's crosses it for us into soil health-based practices, right? So there's a lot of synergy there. So we worked in 12 states, brought about 3,800 fields in. So we were up in the Pacific Northwest, across the upper Midwest, a little bit in the mid-Atlantic, and a little bit in the deep South. So a lot of different kinds of systems, a lot of different kinds of management practices and geographies to work with here. So it comes out to about 642,000 acre years of data. It's a significant data resource driven on precision ag data, okay? I'm going to go right to the bottom line, okay? Across all acres and all years, it's about $405 million in revenue across this data set, against about just under $400 million in total expenses for a whopping annualized ROI of about 46 basis points, right? As a farmer, I say, what am I doing, right? Spending all this money to get that kind of a return. It's a little bit reflective of lower or adjusted commodity prices and some of the things we're facing there. But this gives us a really substantial data set to work from. All right, so let's bring that back to what it means in field. So over 90% of the fields that came through in this data set had multi-year zones that consistently lost money. Okay, over 50% of the acres actually fell into multi-year loss zones, which is a little bit staggering and surprising, but we're starting to understand that a little bit. And then even more important from a conservation practice standpoint,
Over 53% of those multi-year loss zones had potential resource concerns, meaning we can go and attack practices through a make more money conversation and have substantial impact in terms of area pretty quickly. Let's go a little bit further into that. So characterizing this data set into different categories of zones, what you see is these five different breakdowns go from highly unprofitable at the top to highly profitable at the bottom, right? Categorized by return. And then we've got a number of environmental metrics. These are derived through models, typically NRCS approaches with some other biogeochemistry approaches pulled in there. These models are not perfect, but if they're used correctly, they can give us good indicators. What we see is that metric by metric by metric, places where we're consistently losing money are places where we see worse environmental performance. Okay, so that's another bonus in our back pocket. Now, on top of that, if we come in and we identify where we're likely to see different resource concerns and which resource concerns we identify, again, characterized by those different zones, we see that highly unprofitable zones tend to have more than one resource concern. All right, so what this all comes around to is that we can come in, have a make more money conversation with our farmers very quickly, and we can address the worst problems and several of the worst problems in terms of our environmental outcomes. How do we make it real? How does this actually move into commercial ag production systems in a practical way? Well, it gets into zone-based management concepts. What we see is about 75 to 95% of every field we work in fall in what we call a revenue zone. Right? This is where it makes sense for us to invest our money to try and maximize yield, maximize revenue. Okay, this is effectively what we do on every acre now. It's a little bit of a stark reality as we get into this and we say, wait a minute, yield doesn't always win, right? Yield only wins when you can get it at the right cost point. Okay, we also see what we call no-cost zones. These are places where there's no historical precedent dictating it makes sense to spend the money it takes to grow the row crop. It's just not going to generate enough return, and there's no magic here. We have a pretty good idea where these places are in our fields. Getting them characterized and operational is the interesting piece. We also see what we call expense-limited zones. We have various different kinds of constraints on how much revenue we can generate, and so we just have to calibrate our business plan to be able to work within that context. All right, so we have a process that we go through, and we're not going to dig into this in detail, but a couple of quick examples. So one of the first things that we have to do is really effectively understand what's happening now. So we call this a business performance review. What you see here is one of our fields in north central Iowa. This is right in prairie pothole country, all right, right on the Des Moines lobe. Okay, this is about 155-acre field. There's a profit map with some key metrics. Apologize if they're hard to make out on there. But all business performance focus. Okay, and then on the lower right is a subset of our fields ranked by ROI. Okay, I sent my dad into the banker with a 147-page report, a little bit for shock value versus actual productive value, but on top of it was a list of our fields ranked by ROI. And the banker said in 20-plus years of doing this that he had never seen that kind of information before, and that kind of understanding on how the money he's lending turns into return might be the difference between being able to say yes or no on an operating loan as we continue to work in tight margins. All right, so if we give a farmer a list of their fields ranked by ROI or profit, or if there's another metric we want to zero in on, typically what we're going to do is go to the bottom of the list, say, how do I increase revenue? We're programmed to drive profitability through yield, okay? That's fundamentally how we would approach that. When we look at this process and execute it on our own operation, the first field we made a change to was actually the most profitable field in the operation that year. The reason is that it's obvious. In 15 years of farming this field, it's never been as profitable as it was in this year, which happened to be 2015. Okay, and I still had 10 acres of potholes that lost over $500 an acre. Okay, sit back and look at the previous years and you say, wow, what are we doing? This doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, and this is even a leased field. So this is very simple, right? It's conservation practices that get a payment on these acres. It's not hard to farm around. It's very manageable within the context of the precision ag system. And I increase return 2.5% on what was my most profitable field that year. We see this theme play itself out over and over and over again as we work through.
So how do we actually, moving down the list, right, how do we actually create a set of alternatives that are actionable that we can implement and work with farmers on? We tend to see our solutions in these four categories. The agronomic decisions that we all work on quite a bit in this room. And we have a pretty deep toolbox, right? Big Ag has delivered a pretty deep toolbox on agronomic solutions that we can execute here. And it's all the standard things we want to work through. We see land improvement is one of the options, and typically it's dealing with water, right? Get rid of it, bring it back. One of those two issues. What we do tend to see is that some of those land improvement investments don't necessarily generate us return on our dollars the way we think they might as we start understanding it a little bit better. Precision ag is a really big piece of this. We view precision ag perhaps a little bit differently than a lot of folks. We think in the near term it's going to be as much or more about cost containment than it is about revenue enhancement, right? Let's manage our costs versus deploying precision ag to drive more yield. And then there's a whole bucket of business models we call alternative low-cost revenue sources. Okay, we'll get pigeonholed from time to time as guys trying to go find parts of fields and turn them into conservation programs. It's not true. We like market-based solutions. Conservation programs are a nice tool in the mix because it's a very simple business model to work in. I can sign it up against a predictable and consistent payment structure and build my business plan around it. But what we really like are market-based solutions that offer us flexibility moving through. So a tangible example here, 145-acre field in north central Iowa, really, really light soil. We were talking about, this is Sparta, the Sparta soil, Nick, that we talked about. I mean, sand, right? And there's no secret here that there's been a yield problem in the many, many years of farming it. But when my dad saw we're losing over $500 an acre every year consistently on this 15-acre ridge through here, that was actually informative, right? You don't necessarily process that low yield with the overall economic impact. So this was a simple choice where we actually took that ridge and we put it into pollinator habitat. So 15 acres in a pattern that we deemed operationally manageable. Okay, and it increased our profitability, 15 acres out of 145. It increased whole field profitability $45 an acre. More than doubled our return on investment from the field from about 6% historically to over 12.5%. Okay, now, how does this come back to the soil health conversation more and more here? So remembering that this was driven entirely through that make more money conversation, let's look at some of the environmental impacts that we're seeing here. We actually take soil erosion from a little over 200 tons across the whole field down to under 70. Don't have great context on that. It sounds big, right? So we like graphics like this, where I was effectively driving off that field with 10, 20-ton dump trucks of topsoil every year. Okay, that makes me pretty uncomfortable. Then we bring that down to about 3.5, which actually still doesn't feel really good. But we're now getting into where we can think about formation rates at the right level. Driving up organic matter, driving down leaching, all of these important parameters that we want to start to track and bring through. All right, so let's think about how we make this actually operational. What's the conversation thinking about soil health getting out to the farmer? There's four triggers. If we can hit any one, and particularly if we can hit multiple of these triggers, we can have success in a soil health practice or a conservation practice conversation very, very quickly. Right off the bat, if we can show that we improve annual cash flow, that's easy, right? If we improve annual cash flow, we're in the game and it works really, really quickly. If we can talk about the asset value piece. Now, everybody's got visions on how we can move soil health and soil quality-based metrics into the real estate arena. It actually can be simpler than that. If you think about that field where we put the pollinator habitat, we reframed those field boundaries. And if you look at standard sort of soil indices that we trade, corn suitability rating is what we trade soil farm land real estate in Iowa against, we actually have a really significant up to $1,200, $1,300 an acre impact on the valuation of that by changing the defined tillable acres, right, and showing the improved annual cash flow. There's very simple ways where we can actually manage to improve that real estate value. The idea of alternative and more diversified revenue sources is pretty important here. And then over time, the market access piece.
And that's probably not a near-term thing, but we can see that the consumers are coming through the food companies, and ultimately we're going to have certain performance requirements associated with the commodities that we're producing. And if we don't achieve them, then we're going to run into problems, right? Any of these four, and we can start to move into this and make this real. All right, so another quick example. This is a central Iowa field, and we'll look at some pieces here. So this is raw yield monitor data. Okay, this field, we've got application data, we've got planting data, several other pieces, but these are real data resources that are widely available, more so in certain geographies and more so in some cropping systems. But we have this information at our fingertips, and honestly, there's been a lot of money invested to generate the information, and it's not used all that effectively at this point in time. So we're working on a 9-meter grid here, so think 30 foot. Most of what we do is actually down in that 10-foot grid arena, but we're going to look at this one on a 9-meter grid. Every one of those 9-meter grid cells in this field is going to get its own profit and loss financial statements, okay? And we want every single one of those 9-meter grid cells to be a business that can stand up on its own and function on its own profitably. And if it can't, we need to ask the question of, do we really want to continue to operate this business? Or what's the business model that we need to transition to? So when we move that forward, you can see the subfield profit map, wide variability, right? We're highly profitable in areas, highly unprofitable in other. It's no secrets here. We all understand this. I think the extent to which that profitability varies is a little bit surprising in some cases. But we see some standard effects, some edge effects, some turning headlands, some corner effects. These are things that are pretty common, and it's not all just around calibration of the machines. I can verify that too. Then we can come in and we can start to look at some of the environmental outcomes. All right, so how does this feed through? And we look at carbon change. Again, imperfect models, but useful if we understand what we're trying to do with the results. Similarly on nitrate leaching, you can see the soil texture effects on nitrate leaching, and you can see some wide variance. We're down at some pretty low levels at parts of this field. We're at some really substantial nitrate leaching losses in parts of the field also, and this is driven by the productivity and the soil texture as it comes through. Understanding how these fit together is important. So what we've done here is actually every one of those dots on this plot is one of those 9-meter grid cells, okay? And we plotted profitability against nitrate leaching. The striations you see through here are different soil textures, all right? And the models will obviously pick that up in a very important way in terms of how they run through these nitrogen processes mechanistically. Not surprisingly, as nitrate leaching goes up, profitability goes down. Okay, everybody would expect that. What is interesting here, though, is that the cost of the nitrogen that's lost doesn't come anywhere close to describing the total impact on profitability. Okay, so what we can take away from this is, hey, when we start talking about practices that reduce nitrate leaching, do we have the opportunity to have a much more substantial impact on overall profitability? And we would all expect yes, but it's kind of where we can come at this from that conversation of making more money, drive to practices that have substantial impacts, and we don't necessarily have to have everything fully defined underneath the hood on the how and the why, right? This is how we can get folks engaged. And I'll say that the most effective conversation from my perspective on a soil health, in my experience with soil health, is the water infiltration piece. This picture on the lower right is one of our fields last September, and some people might have remembered in North Iowa we had quite a flood event. There was about 15 to 17 inches of rain in less than a 24-hour period here. That's fully grown black layer of corn that you just see the tassels sticking out of. Right now, I'm not pretending that I can soil health my way into infiltrating 15 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, but that conversation is really, really impactful, right? The aggregate stability and that water infiltration rate conversation is one of them that really hits home with farmers quickly right now. So closing out here, I want to highlight how we're working with Soil Health Partnership to actually push this forward. The figure on the right is one of the reports that folks are getting, and this is the strip trial network comparing the controls against the actual practices that are implemented. And we're going to start by saying, what's happening on the make more money conversation? How is this impacting the business? Okay, and this is really, really effective in terms of starting to move this through. Then we can aggregate it, right? And we can start to communicate at a state level, like what you're seeing there on the left, how these different practices are impacting the business outcomes directly. And then obviously the whole partnership's built around bringing more and more of the science elements and the whys and constituting the recommendation process to start to get through. But this is a really important piece. If we can get out and we can talk about how these practices that we fully understand are going to be impactful in a positive way can impact profitability, and we can do it with full transparency. Hey, year one, you're not going to see an impact. It's going to be year three, and it's going to be under these circumstances. Starting to get that transparency and set those expectations, but the business performance conversation for the farmer is going to be really, really important. I don't know where we're at on time. I tried to go pretty quick.
You moved pretty quick. All right. We probably have a minute or two for questions if people have questions.
Did you publish something?
Several pieces. These reports are pretty fresh off the presses. We'll have to catch up on exactly. I would say that there's some probably annual report kinds of summaries that will start to come out, but we don't have a complete definition. A lot of the other data resources are in the public domain, and I can happy to help point in that direction. Oh yeah. Well, so I'll answer with a question I get all the time. Say, well, hey, this is a cash rented field. How do I not generate revenue? What's the trigger for me to say I shouldn't farm this anymore? And it's actually really, really simple, right? So if your consistent loss is higher than your cash rent payment, don't farm it, right? Pay the cash rent and walk away from it, and you're going to have an economically positive return. It's really that simple, and we have farms. This is my dad. It took years to kind of get his mind wrapped around this. Look, you're going to have a positive financial outcome literally not farming a cash rent acre here, and it's got to be operationally manageable, certainly that fits in. But I like, just as a quick example, I'll be quick. So we're going to be out of farming turning headlands within 5 years. We're about a 2,500-acre operation up there. We will not farm any turning headlands within 5 years. And my preferred outcome will be high-protein forage grasses, okay, that we set up some contracts and start to deliver. And I don't even have to make money on it for it to be a positive outcome, right? If we're even within, say, a 5% loss area, that's a significant positive outcome in terms of protecting working capital and overall financial impact on the operation. But with that, there's a couple of fields that will qualify for CP21, the buffer strip program, that we'll probably look at going down that route a little bit. And then in terms of NRCS versus FSA programs right now on leased ground, you can get the pass-through 2014 Farm Bill if you have a landowner that exceeds the annual income levels to get a payment. You can actually do a pass through. That pollinator habitat field is actually one that is in that arena. So we sign up for the program, and it's transferable if it has to go to a new tenant. We still pay the cash rent, and we get the payment for the practice from FSA. That is not available on the NRCS side of programs and the cost share side yet, but it's a really nice tool, actually. And so we went from losing $500 an acre or more on those 15 acres to the pollinator payment's about $290 an acre, and the cash rent's about $250.
Additional comments or questions for Dave?
So a lot of the profits are based on cost reduction and fluctuating markets. Have you looked into, with ag solvers, their ability to look in different scenarios, like let's say this farmer, raises a certain premium crop, a certain niche crop, where it might have a higher value, how that might play in, and say like, hey, farmer X, if you plant this crop, this is a different scenario in terms of profit.
You bet. So everything we do is actually built around scenario planning.
the getting a baseline understanding of what's going on is just where you start. The whole system's built around trying to construct and test different scenarios in order to create a business plan. Right, this precision business planning process is really the key outcome. And so it lets you, it's set up to be able to do things spatially. We can bring in as intended maps if you want to talk about precision management, seeding rates, all of those sorts of pieces. Certainly the economic story, the crop budgeting story is configurable in a scenario context. But yeah, you're exactly right. It's not that useful until you have the chance to test different scenarios. Now, the caveat to that is that farmers really don't want to spend a lot of time in front of computers. The ag tech industry hasn't seemed to figure this out very well yet. So we're still kind of getting around that hurdle. And so automating scenarios and simplifying how you can look at different options as the teaser to make it very quickly consumable information is very important for the farmer, but then fine-tuning it to an operation. The other thing that, and I say this with my farmer hat on so I can say it, we don't really understand our costs that well anyway, is one of the pieces that we realize.
One example is like, you know, way organic grain premiums are right now, like you need to have really reduced yields, but the premiums are so high that people, like, you know, I know some farmers are going that route, but like they're printing money.
Basically. Absolutely. Yeah, we our entire operation is non-GMO waxy corn, right? And it's literally the marketing opportunity that's associated with it, the premium goes through Cargill, ends up in the EU, and we can sell ahead, we can create different delivery, we can operate on a locked-in 5-cent basis. It's exactly that kind of a construct.
All right, well, thank you, Dave.
Thanks.
Appreciate the comments.